Well, for Henry Grossman, the key has always been the interplay of shadow and light. That's what often makes for a great photograph. That's what made Henry Grossman a world-renowned photographer. That's what gave him unprecedented access to the Beatles and invitations into the Beatles' homes to photograph them with their friends and family. He shot their first appearance on The Ed Sullivan Show. His approach also gave him access to the Oval Office and access to John Kennedy. Henry Grossman wound up taking what Jackie Kennedy once described as her favorite photograph of her husband. Henry Grossman shot the wedding of Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton and assignments for Life magazine, The New York Times, Time magazine, Newsweek, Paris Match, and so many others during the golden age of photojournalism. He's published several books and was an actor and as an operatic tenor, sang at the New York Metropolitan Opera on Broadway. He's in town visiting family, and we just couldn't pass up a chance to talk to Henry Grossman. And welcome. So good to have you here.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
What a life.
It's been great. I'm very grateful for it.
You got the pipes. Listen to your pipes. That's the one you're a singer on.
Vocalizing.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
Thank you.
Here's something that amazed me. You weren't even that excited about the Beatles when you first began shooting them, which is kind of hard to believe because you were roughly their age. Why not?
I was studying classical music. I wanted to be a singer. I was an actor. Wanted to be a singer.
You were in a whole different orbit from where
absolutely.
They were.
Absolutely. I didn't understand the rock, the beat, the noise, and this kind of thing. And when Time magazine sent me over to the Ed Sullivan Theater, which was a block away from where I lived, I went, but I didn't know what to expect. It was a lot of noise.
What did you make of it?
I don't even think the audience could hear the sound. They were screaming so much. But I enjoyed the Beatles. I went to their first press conference in New York. I later went to the Rolling Stones press conference and never went back. I didn't like the Rolling Stones. I loved the Beatles. I didn't listen to their music. I can now, and I love it now. But at that time, I was not a Beatle fan, except for liking the Beatles themselves.
But you took to them why, Henry? What was it?
They were very smart. They weren't putting on. They weren't saying, I am this, I am that. At one point, I was photographing for a cover for Life magazine. Ringo had a bright tie, sort of a psychedelic tie, and I was wearing a paisley, quiet tie. And I said, Ringo, I wish I had the guts to wear a tie like that. He came over, fingered my tie, looked me in the eye and said, well, Henry, if you did, it would still be Henry, but with a bright tie. How could you not learn from that? I learned from that.
You also tell a story about Ringo, if I remember it correctly, Henry, about their time in America. And you asked them what they thought of it. And it was to Ringo again. And Ringo walked over to the window with you and looked out and saw what?
A block away, there was a brick wall where a building had been torn down in between. An empty parking lot down below. We were up maybe 15 or 20 stories. He looked out and said, Henry, this is all we're seeing of America. They couldn't go out because they would be mobbed on the streets.
Mm-hmm. They wound up taking to you. Why? Because so many people wanted to be in your shoes. What was it about you think that connected with them?
I was only about 3 or 4 years older than they were. A lot of the other photographers around them at that time from newspapers and whatnot were middle-aged, much older guys. Also, I wasn't asking them to pose for things. I was more of a fly on the wall. I wanted to observe and watch what happened and observe the behavior and who they were. And one of my favorite quotes is from Emerson, who said, stop talking. Who you are speaks so loudly, I can hardly hear what you're saying.
What a great line.
That is a great line.
What a great line. And that was your approach to photographing the Beatles.
To photographing anybody.
Mm-hmm.
I loved it.
Mm-hmm. Stay in the background. Observe.
It's not about me. It's about them.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be the first word of advice I give to a young photographer, asking, what advice do you have for me? I'm going on an assignment tomorrow. I said, just remember, it's not about you. It's about the people you're working with and photographing and wanting to tell about. Well, kind of like what you do.
Mm-hmm. But so many photographers sort of want a little bit of attention, right? They stand up and walk in front of the lights and they sort of want to be seen as something important.
I don't know. That's not what I would do. I do that when I'm in theater, but I don't want to do that when I'm working or when I'm taking pictures.
You were known, Henry, for for taking unusual shots, unusual angles, I guess is what I mean. You were widely respected for that. For instance, you would walk behind the Beatles and shoot the rows of photographers shooting them and offer your viewers a different vantage point from the world the Beatles were living. How did you calculate what those angles would be?
There was no calculation. It's just what happened and what I saw. For example, I was in Bobby Kennedy's campaign to become president. I was his photographer trying to get poster pictures for him. And we reached Nebraska. There was about a 20-minute drive to the next town. I sat in back with an aide. He lay down in the front seat to take a nap because we were up at 6 o'clock in the morning that day. And I got a wonderful picture, one of my favorite pictures of the back of Bobby Kennedy is lying on the chair on the seat of the car, and the empty road up ahead, and it says Kennedy on the car head. That was marvelous. It happened. I was with Pavarotti. Was rehearsing for an opera in Japan. We were in a hotel suite, and he was sitting near a window, and it looked great. I went and shot a portrait. He looked at me, reached across, took the curtain from next to him, pulled it across half of his face.
I remember that photograph.
And waited till I shot it, and the last shot is only the curtain, as he covered himself completely with that. Things happen that way. You watch and you see. You never know what's going to happen. Just keep yourself alert. The other thing is people are taking pictures all the time with the cell phones and things like this. I think that's marvelous. It's not going to put me out of work because it's the vision. It's what I'm seeing and what you're seeing as a public. And when you're walking around and you see something, shoot it. My God, why not?
Mm. As you're talking here, Pavarotti, the Kennedys, the Beatles, the Stones, did you have a sense at the time that just how extraordinary this was?
No, I did not.
How could you not?
I mean, I was going from one assignment to the next, to the next, to the next. Some days I'd be working in the morning for Life magazine and that same afternoon for Time magazine, and maybe that evening shooting a Broadway show or something like that. And it was busy. And my Beatle photographs stood on my shelves for almost 40 years after the negatives had been returned to me from Life magazine because they were finished syndicating or whatever. And finally, these two young guys from...
I was going to ask you about this. No one knew you had this stuff.
I didn't know I had it.
You didn't know you had it.
I mean, I knew I had it, but I didn't know what to do with it. And Kevin and Brian came to me, said, we're doing a book. We want to do a book on your photos. You have the largest unseen photograph collection of the Beatles. I had no idea.
And even then, they didn't know how much you had.
I didn't know because actually in going through the contact sheets, they ran across a picture of Bob Dylan entering a hotel room in New York during the Beatles' visit. And they said, oh, my God, look what you got. And I said, what are you talking about? It's nothing picture. It's Bob Dylan.
It was important.
It was important because this was the day that Bob Dylan visited them and introduced them to pop. Mm-hmm. Wow.
And you had the moment that happened.
I didn't realize it. I had another picture of John Lennon. George asked me to, when we were in Australia, George said, Henry, can we take some pictures of me and Patty when I get back to London? And I said, sure. So I went to George's house. We took some pictures. He said, let's go visit John. So we went over to John's house. And while they were riffing among themselves with the two guitars, the girls, ladies of the house were in the other room looking at curtains and this kind of stuff. And I had a picture from that session where John sat down on a sofa with a TV screen in front of him.
And that was seen as significant because?
Because John had said in an interview, yes, he often turned on the TV, turned off the sound. And composed pictures. I didn't know. It looked like just a nothing picture to me.
Mm-hmm.
But Brian and Kevin knowing about that was marvelous. They were Beatle fans. They loved the Beatles also. They knew everything that had been written about them. I didn't know all of that. And how wonderful that picture has meaning. There was another picture. I was going to touch out a small spot on a coat that George Harrison was wearing. And I said, maybe we'll take that out. My eye is distracted by it a little. He said, no, don't do that. Because everybody who's a Beatle fan would know what that insignia is and would say, where's his button? Where's that thing that he wears on his lapel? We left it alone.
Hmm. Do I understand right? Was George the one you became closest to?
George was the one I became closest to. And whenever I went to London for any reason, I was going to do stills in a movie or something like that or another assignment, I'd call the office of Apple because their phone numbers, though I had the phone number, it would change almost every week. Mm. Telephone number du jour.
For George Harrison you're talking about.
For George Harrison or the other guys.
Yeah.
And I'd call the office and George would call me back at the hotel and we'd arrange to meet the next day. I'd go over to George's house and it was great. And one time...
You would go over there and George would go about his day, Henry, and you would just sort of...
No, he'd just show me around and show me his apartment, his house. Not an apartment, it was a ranch house. And at one point, there was an instrument on the wall that I didn't recall ever seeing. And I said, what is that? He reached up and took it down, which meant, one, that it wasn't there just for decoration. He started trying to tune it. And he said, this is a sitar, I can't find anybody to teach me how to play it. I looked at him. I said, George, you make a lot of money? He smiled. And I said, you could probably afford to find the best sitar teacher in India and bring him here to teach you. I didn't go any further. And he went to India and found a sitar teacher and studied sitar teaching, sitar, there. The next time I visited him after he got back from India, he greets me at the door, looks down at my shoes and says, wouldn't you like to take your shoes off, Henry? And he's barefoot and wearing an Indian garb. And I said, oh, sure. We go in, and so he'd been to India. There was a give and take between us. George, on the first visit to New York, had said to me, Henry, what's another word for this word? I don't remember what it was. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, let's look it up in Roger's Thesaurus. He said, what's that? So I went out and bought him a Roger's Thesaurus, which had all kinds of words.
Sure.
And later on, I saw in an interview, he said, it was only after a friend had given me the gift of a thesaurus that I was able to find the words that I needed, da-da-da-da-da-da.
Oh,
and so it was back and forth. I learned from them, and I think they learned from me. At one point, the interesting thing was I have a recording that I made with George just talking, and he said, Henry, who knows how long this will last? And that was over 50 years ago.
Oh, no kidding. Yeah. Your photographs, I should point out, were turned into these compilation books, very expensive $500 books.
Limited edition.
Limited edition that sold out very quickly of so much of what you have. And if people are interested, you've got a website, henrygrossman.com.
Yes.
People can go and order some of these images,
absolutely,
not all of them.
Yeah. Absolutely. My son is handling all my business things. I don't know how to do that anymore. I'm not as up on IT stuff as I should be.
You also were with the Beatles on a pivotal day for them, the day that Brian Epstein died.
Yes.
Their longtime, their founding manager. What was that like?
Well, we were in Bangor, Wales with the Maharishi. I was shooting for Time magazine. We were working on a cover story about the Beatles. And Time magazine sent me, and we got word in the afternoon that Brian had died, and everybody was scrambling to find a way back to London. I had this car that Time magazine had given me with a driver, so I let it be known that anybody needed a ride, we can go back, you know, whatever. And Paul and his girlfriend, Jane Asher, rode back to London with me in the car. It was about a six-hour ride, and I was just being a friend. I was being a presence there for they wanted to talk. I was not asking them. There was not a reporter saying, well, how did you feel knowing? Not that. That was not me.
How did he react to that news?
The reporters were asking, ganging up in the car as we were pulling out and yelling at him, what do you feel about Brian's death? Come on. He said, under his breath, he said, they want to know, how did I feel? Mumbled something and we just kept quiet in the car on the way back. They napped. I napped. That was it.
Wow. That's just extraordinary. You also got very close to a different world, the world of politics.
Ooh.
John Kennedy, his family. And you were with John F. Kennedy on the day he announced his candidacy for the presidency of the United States.
I was a graduate student at Brandeis, and he announced in Washington, flew to Brandeis because Eleanor Roosevelt, who was teaching there that year, had a TV show from Brandeis, and John Kennedy wanted her approval. He came to Boston, appeared on the show. She did not give her approval because she wanted Adlai Stevenson to be the president. But I got great pictures. I gave them to Kennedy and his aides. And whenever I had the opportunity, when he was nearby on the East Coast, I went and joined them for the campaign a bit and this kind of thing. It was marvelous to see him grow because he was very tentative and nervous in that first day. And I saw a point where the producer said, "Senator, can you give a 10-minute speech to the to support GBH, public radio?" And he said, "Sure." And he said it and then started to take the microphone off, and the producer said, "Senator, now we'd like to run it." I had seen the producer signal not to run the TV. And when he said that, Kennedy slammed the microphone down on his chest and said, "You mean you didn't run it?" And he did it again. And I said to myself, wow, he'd push the button if he were president. I got scared. But I saw how the audience reaction to him when he was on tour and as he grew during the campaign and the confidence grew was marvelous to see. Kennedy was charming and right there in Connecticut. The energy was incredible.
You know, I get the sense, I'm not a photographer, but, you know, John F. Kennedy, a handsome man, the Beatles seemed, at least to my way of thinking, to love to mug in front of the cameras. Were these hard people to photograph?
No. No, I'm not. I have lots of pictures of Kennedy that were not great pictures. As a matter of fact, this summer I was going up with an intern. I was in California and I was going over with Skype some of the contact sheets on the on Skype and identifying people in pictures with Kennedy. And there are whole contact sheets where I didn't like the way Kennedy looked in the picture. So that many times he looked great, often he did not. Hmm. And there are lots of pictures I would not show anybody. Lyndon Johnson, the saying was, did you ever see the Lyndon mask? Two left sides. If you entered the room and he was talking to somebody and you were entering on his right side, he would, without even looking at you, turn his guest around so that he showed you his left side while you were photographing.
Because he was convinced that was his better side.
Yes, he thought that was his better side.
Wow.
I was in Washington during the Civil Rights Bill signing. And what was fascinating was the guests were aligned in a row, in the front row, across from the press. And Johnson was seated in between, so his profile was dressed. And every head in the room was turned toward Lyndon, except Bobby Kennedy was staring straight ahead, and only out of the corner of his eyes would look like, you know, cast a glance that way.
Because they didn't like each other.
No, they did not. And mm-hmm. It should have been Jack's bill, for God's sake. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And when they stood up at the end, the Speaker of the House, McCormick, was sitting nearby and went over to Bobby and took him by the arms. And I have a picture. He's almost like saying, "Get yourself together, kid." And then everybody went over to collect a souvenir pen from the president. And when the president looked up and saw it was Bobby behind him, he reached down and took about 5 pens in his hands and almost apologetically handed 5 pens to Bobby. Hmm. My last picture, Bobby Kennedy standing amid all these empty chairs askew in the East Room of the White House, looking very lost, holding a little box with a handful of pens.
Hmm. Yeah. You know, there's a famous portrait of Jack Kennedy that you took that Jackie Kennedy later described as her favorite photograph of her husband. I think we'll have it for our website, if it's not up right now, later on today at kcur.org. It's a picture of Kennedy sort of looking off in one direction, eyes up, hair sort of tousled. Do you remember the moment?
Oh, that was at the Battery Park in New York City in May of 1963. And I loved the picture.
Just 5-6 months before he died.
Yeah. And I gave Jackie a print of that. And the next morning, a friend of mine, Sal Linowitz, had been the chairman of Xerox. And I used to do photos for Xerox. And Sal called me and said, "Henry, Jackie probably wouldn't tell you this, but I was at dinner at her house last night. And she kept getting up from the dinner table and going over to look at this picture." Hmm. And I said, "Jackie, what is it?" She said, "I think it's my favorite photo of Jack." So Sal called me the next morning to tell me that. I thought that was very lovely. It was a picture that Time magazine had an artist in Germany paint a copy of in color. It ran on the 25th anniversary issue of JFK's death on the cover of Time magazine in color.
you didn't have any formal training in photography, if I understand correctly, but your father had a big influence on how you learned. But if I understand right, Henry, he was not a photographer per se. He did portraiture in other mediums. Do I have that right?
You're right. He was an etcher, etched on copper plates, which he then printed.
And what did he teach you about shadow and light? Because those elements are so important in the work you did.
He didn't convey the teaching as much as his work conveyed the teaching. I saw portrait after portrait. He did Einstein, ahead of Einstein. Einstein hadn't left Germany yet. It was 1931. He did Gandhi at a financial conference in London in 1931. He did Tagore and a lot of famous people, and did Mussolini in 1927 because the American ambassador saw him etching and said, "Would you like to do the Mussolini?" So he did. I had all those images in my face. When my father died, I was 11 going on 12, and eventually I picked up one of my father's cameras, and I went to a vocational high school, learning photography in the morning and afternoon. It was one of the best things I ever did. I mourn the fact that there aren't more vocational high schools. What a wonderful force that could be for today.
Yeah.
Anyway, it stood me in very, very good stead. I then acted and went to a scholarship in theater at Brandeis University and worked for the photographer there. But I was taking famous people who were visiting the university or lecturing at the university and began later to show these pictures to editors in New York. And that's where I got my first assignments. So I distributed a list and whatnot. And so-and-so wasn't on your list, but could you photograph him on an assignment for us?
Wow.
So I did.
You know, Henry, this is painful for me. We're out of time. I hate being out of time with you. This has been just fascinating. I've recognized so many of your great photographs, and it's such a thrill to have you here.
Thank you so much for your knowledgeable background.
Well, we didn't get to your singing. We didn't get to shooting Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton's wedding, and you did so much more stuff.
I loved it. And thank you so much for having me.
It's been a pleasure.